This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll discuss a new technology ushered in by worldwide fears of the COVID-19 pandemic. Apple and Google have created a contact tracing cell phone app in the name of public health. But is this just a new tool for mass surveillance? We'll also examine the drawbacks of law enforcement's facial recognition technology database. There are absolutely no federal regulations or protections governing how police can use this vast pool of personal information. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. From China to Israel and now the United States, governments have either enacted or seek to enact broad contact tracing measures to contain the spread of COVID-19. American leaders haven't said yet how such tracing might actually stop the spread. The Electronic Frontier Foundation notes that such new measures must, quote, be scientifically rigorous and based on the expertise of public health professionals. Absent such a showing, many believe it's too early to warrant the privacy invasion such tracking would bring, and with uses we may not be able to foresee. In a rare collaboration, tech competitors Google and Apple have created a cell phone tracking application. It allows users to voluntarily share data through Bluetooth low energy transmissions. It would keep extensive information on phones that have been in close proximity with each other. Official apps from public health authorities will get access to the data, and users who download them can report if they've been diagnosed with COVID-19. The system will also alert people who download them whether or not they were in close contact with an infected person. Joining us to discuss this issue is Senior Staff Attorney Adam Schwartz from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Adam's legal expertise on surveillance includes warrantless smartphone searches, location tracking, searches of devices at the borders, and biometric surveillance. Adam Schwartz, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Adam, given your life's work, I assume that you suspected electronic contact tracing might become an issue before Google and Facebook announced their collaboration. Am I right?
Yes, we are all too familiar with a pattern, which is that when we have a crisis, the solution from some elements of the government and corporations is to do a lot more surveillance. And surveillance that is proposed and adopted during the crisis in the name of the crisis that has a tendency to stick around. So, for example, within months of the 9/11 terror attacks, the NSA begins on an emergency basis to do dragnet surveillance of the entire internet. And they're still doing it nearly two decades later. And so we all expect that during the pandemic, our lives will change. We want to be responsible. You know, hundreds of millions of us are socially distancing. But surveillance often is not the answer.
Now, we'll get into that in a moment. Let's talk briefly about the app that Google created. It allows for voluntary sharing through Bluetooth. Can you explain how this works in layperson terms?
Sure. At the most general level, a time-tested method of trying to contain a pandemic is to engage in what's called contact tracing, which means when public health authorities know that a person is ill, they interview them to find out who they've been in contact with, and then they interview those people and see if they're ill, and if so, you know, repeat. And so this is a laborious, time-consuming interview-based process. And often it is helpful in containing a pandemic. And so basically, an idea that is being discussed all around the world, it was first implemented in Singapore. A week or two ago, Google and Apple jointly put out an API in order to make these kind of things interoperate. The idea is that in addition to doing the hard work of manual contact tracing, we would supplement it with automatic contact tracing. And the way that would work is that if two phones had downloaded the proximity tracing app, when they come within 2 meters of each other, as measured by Bluetooth signal strength, they exchange what might be called a token. And a token is just a long list of randomly generated numbers. And then if someone gets ill, they report all of the tokens that they gave up to others into a centralized list of ill tokens. And meanwhile, everybody who's downloaded the app, their app is constantly pinging the central list and saying, you know, give me all the random numbers of ill people tokens. And when they get them, they compare the ill tokens to the tokens they've collected, and if there's a match, they are advised by their app they might be infected and they should get tested and until then, self-quarantine. So obviously there's a lot of things that could go wrong there. There's a lot of privacy concerns. There's a lot of questions about effectiveness. But that's the basic idea of proximity-based contact tracing through an app.
Now, what do Google and Apple stand to gain from this rather unusual collaboration between competitors?
So the reason why Google and Apple have come together to do this, obviously, is that most of the people in the United States, if not the world, their phone's operating system is either going to be Google's Android or Apple's iOS. And by the two of those organizations coming together, and well, what the two organizations did so far is they've come together and put out an API, which is a way that operating systems and apps can interact together. And there are many, many different apps that are being proposed and built to do this contact tracing. A necessity for this to work is that a large enough portion of the population is all using the system. If everyone's using a different app, then the system becomes balkanized. By Google and Apple having an API, the systems can interoperate. In terms of what they have to gain, in the immediate short run, there is goodwill for them, which has to be taken into account. As some of these apps are being designed, there is less risk to privacy, and so the hope is that Apple and Google would not obtain the personal information of the users, but that's an open question that needs to be closely scrutinized.
Now, in terms of how the code for the app is calculated, it likely, I would assume, is based on data like users' location, medical and travel history, which they'd probably have to fill out a survey for. Talk about the lawsuit that you filed about a year ago for EFF called Scott v. AT&T about geolocation tracking. What were the facts of that case, and does this have any bearing on how the current app might operate?
Yeah, the two issues, the Scott case and the current COVID questions, are related. So in the Scott versus AT&T lawsuit, which the Electronic Frontier Foundation filed about a year ago, AT&T, as part of the way that it provides service, is constantly gathering information about the location of their consumers through the routine pinging of phones to cell towers to ensure that when someone wants to make a call or receive a call, the system knows where the consumer is. And so this is a very rich record of our lives, and it shows where we've been and therefore who we've been associating with and what we've been doing. Location privacy is a major, major threat for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And what AT&T and the other telco providers did is they sold information about people's locations to other companies. And a vast ecology of the resale of this information appeared, to the point that bounty hunters and skip tracers had the ability to pay very low sums in order to find out where people were. And with so much information washing around, everybody's at risk of identity theft and stalking. And so we have sued them for violating federal consumer privacy laws for telephone consumers and other laws. That case is humming along. In the COVID context, there are all kinds of different ways that government and corporations might surveil people. One that we are absolutely opposed to is location tracking. While the cell site location information is precise enough to be a very big menace to people's privacy, you know, it can place you at a rally, it could place you on the block where a controversial art museum showing its work, near the office of a criminal defense lawyer, all kinds of things. The cell phone location data is not granular enough, even when supplemented by GPS data, to show whether two people were close enough together, 2 meters, that they may have passed the infection. And so location data just per se is not useful in the fight against COVID. And so EFF per se is opposed to location-based tracking to fight COVID. What is different about the Bluetooth-based proximity apps is they don't care where you were. They only care whether or not you were proximate to another person as measured by the signal strength of the Bluetooth. And so where cell site location information and GPS information from our perspective should be absolutely off the table, there may be room for Bluetooth-based proximity tracking as part of a response to the public health crisis.
And I think that's, you've raised at least a couple of important points here. One is it has to be part of a larger, multifaceted system. It can't be what I think some people think would be a silver bullet in dealing with the pandemic. Another issue is, I think there's a misconception out there that metadata is less invasive or revealing about a person than the content of data, so that a history of, say, geolocation tracking data can tell a huge amount about a person's likes, dislikes, relationships, health status, and all of that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Just responding to both of those points. Number one, there is often a view that a brand new magic technology is going to save us, and that we need Silicon Valley to nerd harder, and we can shortchange all the other things, and that's what's going to work. That's absolutely wrong. What we need to deal with the COVID outbreak is what we have been doing for a very long time to deal with the pandemic, which is a lot of manual contact tracing, and that's going to involve thousands and thousands of people working with public health officials to go out and do the interviews. We need widespread testing to see who is infected. We need to have, you know, personal protective equipment and ventilators and all of these things. At best, if a lot of people download this app, it will assist in the process of contact tracing, but it is no panacea. It is not the solution. As to your other point, metadata, you know, absolutely. There sometimes is the claim that there is more sensitive information, for example, the content of what people say to each other on the phone or in an email. And there's less sensitive information, the metadata, you know, such as when two people communicated and how long the conversation went on and where they were. The metadata is so voluminous that the metadata alone can paint a very intimate detail, and from our perspective is every bit as menacing to privacy as the actual content of the communications, which is why we support international standards like the necessary and proportionate principles, which treat the metadata as being as menacing to privacy as the content and supposedly most sensitive personal information. Now, in the context of a proximity tracing app, that means we have to have as little metadata as possible. So to make automated contact tracing with Bluetooth signal strength work, you really just need a very little bit of information. You need exchange these random tokens, which are being rotated through very quickly and are very hard to connect back to a particular person. You need to know the signal strength of the Bluetooth signal. You don't need to know where it was. You don't need to know who it was. You don't need to know even when it was, except maybe to the day, if public health officials say they need that. And that's it. And so your phone has in it just a bunch of random numbers of tokens you got from people that in theory should not be able to be traced back to someone. And then if you're ill, you report in your phone's numbers, and the system doesn't know anything except a bunch of random numbers. It doesn't know where they came from. So on the other hand, there's lots of ways to design this that are not privacy protective, that gather location. In Singapore, when someone's ill, the government, you know, gets a hold of the phone and all the contact information, and it's very privacy invasive. So punchline, these proximity tracking apps, they could be done in ineffective ways and possibly effective ways, and they can be done in ways that are very menacing to privacy or in ways that are possibly privacy preserving. So this is something that has to be gotten right after a lot of careful thought.
And also, it's worth noting that companies' algorithms are designed to go through vast quantities of metadata to look for the patterns and the identifying factors. Adam, I want to ask, what is the term re-identification, and how can the authorities use or misuse that?
A recurring problem in data privacy is there are entities that have these databases of people's personal information, and they contain identifying information. So in the most simplistic way you might imagine, there's a grid with 1,000 people in it, and the first column is the person's name, and the second column is their social security number, third column is, you know, whether or not they have COVID, you know, fourth column might be their travel history. What might be done simplistically is to just delete the columns for name and social security number and leave all the other columns and say, ta-da, we have de-identified this. You know, all you have here is a bunch of information that's not directly related to someone. The problem is that for decades, different entities, a lot of corporations, a lot of government agencies have become really good at de-identifying or at re-identifying. So the privacy protective measure is to de-identify, and then the way to defeat that is to re-identify. And what all kinds of studies have shown is that it is just shockingly easy to re-identify. So one famous example, Netflix took its database of who watched what movie and de-identified it by taking out the names of who watched and just published when particular people were watching movies for purposes of doing a contest to see who could come up with the best algorithm to show people the movies they want. And some very clever data scientists studied this and correlated the supposedly de-identified Netflix database against what people were saying about their movie-watching habits on public available systems and were able to re-identify. And all of a sudden, it's possible for people's intimate information, you know, what movie they were watching and when, to suddenly be publicly available. And so in the context of COVID, anytime someone says, don't worry about the government or this corporation having your sensitive information about location, proximity to other people, health, because, you know, don't worry, we're going to de-identify it, that should be setting off screaming alarm bells because of the history of re-identification, which is why in engineering a Bluetooth proximity tracing app, it is so important to truly minimize the information being collected and engineer it in such a way that, as with some of the models, nothing's being exchanged between two phones besides a constantly changing long string of numbers that don't mean anything, except it's a token of someone who might later report as ill.
Now, Adam, you've emphasized the importance of transparency on the part of our leaders vis-a-vis the apps and other policies that we've discussed around surveillance. Why is transparency so crucial?
Yeah, so just a governing principle for any democratic society needs to be transparency, in the sense that proposals that governments and corporations are taking, which are going to intrude upon our privacy and other freedoms, need to be out in the open. Corporations and governments need to explain what they want to do, why, and how. And if any surveillance ideas are being considered that don't meet that basic test, we just oppose it. And one of the reasons for that, and there are many, is that when systems are developed in secret, they quickly metastasize because there is no accountability and pushback. And so, again, for example, the NSA's Dragnet Internet Surveillance Program was cooked up behind closed doors, and there are still many unknown things about how it works. And in the absence of sunlight, public understanding of what's going on, these things metastasize and get worse. In the particular context of COVID proximity Bluetooth tracing apps, one really, really important aspect of transparency is what is called open source code, meaning the makers of these apps need to put the code out in the open so that security researchers and others can study it and identify bugs that can be exploited by foreign governments or by, identity thieves or whoever, and also to ensure that it does have the privacy protection measures that advocates for these apps say they do. So without transparency, we oppose the programs, and without transparency, they will be less effective, in the sense that they will be buggy and will have errors that can be exploited by adversaries.
And that's an excellent point. With all this gathering of personal data, we have to make sure that protections are in place, just as with data aggregators and everyone who is storing our information, to keep them safe from outside third parties. Now, we have a few minutes left, Adam. I was wondering if you could speak briefly about the need for new surveillance powers, as you have written, to always be both necessary and proportionate. What do you mean by that?
So whenever governments and corporations propose new surveillance to solve any problem, and in particular now to deal with the public health crisis, we ask three questions. And this is not unique to EFF. I think lots of privacy organizations are doing this, and it echoes the necessary and proportionate standards. Number one, we ask, is this going to be effective to solve the problem? And often the answer is no. So as we've discussed, location tracking by GPS and cell tower is not sufficiently granular to show whether two people were within 6 feet of each other, which is the CDC definition of where people are at the greatest risk of transmitting the disease. And so, therefore, location-based tracking will not be effective if you deal with COVID, and we oppose it. The second question is, assuming that it's potentially effective, is it simply too intrusive on our liberties, that it's just not tolerable to a democratic society? And so, for example, NSA Dragnet Internet surveillance, even if once in a while they might get a clue about terrorism, it's just too intrusive on our freedoms, and we oppose it. Likewise, there are ideas doing face surveillance through public-facing cameras to try to identify people who ought to be in quarantine. We're just against that per se, because we think government face surveillance is too menacing to our freedoms. Assuming that a technology is both potentially effective and not so intrusive to our freedoms that we just can't do it at all, our third question is, are there enough safeguards? And here we look at things like, is it voluntary? Is there a minimization of the data that's being collected and retained? Is there transparency? Are there measures to ensure that it's not going to unfairly burden vulnerable groups like immigrants and people of color? These kinds of tests. So again, to simplify, you know, one, will it work? Is it effective? Two, is it simply too intrusive on our freedoms? And three, are there enough safeguards? And lots of the ideas that are being proposed to address COVID fail these tests. It's possible that apps can be developed that do narrow proximity tracking with Bluetooth signal strength, that if they are sufficiently, you know, privacy engineered and limited by policy, might be a small part of the larger public health response.
Adam, a final question. Do you think that Americans have become savvy about mass surveillance enough to question in depth new measures that are being proposed?
I think that there have been some polls which show some skepticism by the public to new surveillance. There was a Morning Consult poll several weeks ago that expressed doubt about the benefits of companies giving location information over to the government to deal with COVID. You know, at EFF, we are fundamentally optimistic that the public is protective of their privacy and other rights. And, you know, I think we're in a situation we've never been in before, where there really has been a national solidarity to do shelter in place. And people are scared and want to get out. But we are not seeing a groundswell of demand for more surveillance to address this problem.
Adam, it's really been a pleasure talking with you this morning. How can listeners read things that you've written and learn more about your work at the Electronic Frontier Foundation?
So our website is EFF.org, the acronym for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And on our front page, there is a button that's called COVID and Digital Rights. And if you click that, we have nearly 40 blog posts up about all manner of issues concerning COVID, especially the surveillance issues that we've talked about today. But we've also talked about a lot of issues around free speech and innovation, transparency, just the experience of living more online. All of these things have been affected by COVID, and you know, I hope your listeners will tune in and check out our materials.
Adam Schwartz, a pleasure. Thank you for your important work.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Surveillance cameras across the United States has enabled targeted facial recognition surveillance at essentially any place and any time. Each day, law enforcement puts in place more and more cameras, including CCTV, police body cameras, and cameras on drones and other aircraft. The FBI's Next Generation Biometric Identification Database and its Facial Recognition Unit, Face Services, can search for and identify nearly 64 million Americans, either from its own databases or through access to state DMV databases of driving license photos. It's likely that government agencies will soon be able to pinpoint your location, and even with whom you've been, just by typing your name into a computer. The release of Apple's iPhone X has drawn scrutiny to this technology. Despite civil liberties and privacy concerns, there are few limits on facial recognition technology. In March 2017, Congress held a hearing to discuss the risks of this surveillance. There's concern that facial recognition can be used to get around existing legal protections against location tracking, opening the door to unprecedented government monitoring and logging of personal associations, including protected First Amendment-related activities. Here to talk about this technology is Claire Garvey. Claire is a law fellow at the Georgetown Law Center on Privacy and Technology. Her research with the center is on facial recognition use by law enforcement. She worked on the center's 2016 report on this topic called Perpetual Lineup. Claire, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us, how long has facial recognition been used in this country?
Facial recognition is a relatively new technology, and we really only see its use by law enforcement specifically start gaining traction 2008 or so. But the oldest system used by police in the U.S. Has actually been in operation since 2001. That's the system that operates in Florida out of Pinellas County.
And I suppose that's why we've seen it on police procedural TV shows for at least a decade.
That's right. Yes. And, of course, science fiction loves the idea of new technologies and pushing the boundaries of what we think is possible in the future. So it makes sense that we saw it in on TV shows sort of before we were aware of its use in real life.
So tell us approximately how many Americans already have images stored in law enforcement facial recognition networks, to the best of your knowledge.
Over half of all American adults are in a face recognition database. This is a biometric database of your face that is accessible to law enforcement for criminal justice searches, thanks not to any engagement or prior interaction with law enforcement, but because you got a driver's license. 30 states across the country, at least, allow law enforcement agencies either direct access or the ability to request searches of face recognition systems that run on driver's license photos.
I think many of our listeners are going to be surprised by that. I had never really given that thought. So you're saying you have a driver's license, that photo's in a database, law enforcement can access that.
That's correct. Yes, in 30 states.
In 30 states.
Yes.
What about passports?
Passport photos are also have been optimized to be searchable by face recognition. This is predominantly to what's called deduplicate, or to verify the information to make sure somebody's not getting a fraudulent passport. This is the same reason why driver's license databases are also face recognition optimized. But yes, all visa photos, all passport photos are also in a face recognition database.
Now, Claire, what I found fascinating was real-time matches. Can you explain how many seconds it takes to take a match through this system, and what are real-time matches?
When we talk about real-time matches, what we're talking about is the ability of face recognition to run off of a live video feed. It may be a matter of seconds, so in technically speaking, it might not be instantaneous or in real time, but for the purposes of somebody walking past a camera, it very much is real in real time because it pinpoints their location at a given point in time. So face recognition is uniquely able to be used as a surveillance tool. Much like fingerprinting, it is a way to biometrically identify somebody. But unlike fingerprinting, it can be captured remotely in secret, and it can be used on groups of people, which means when we talk about real-time face recognition, we're talking about systems where surveillance cameras are actually scanning the faces of people walking by, maybe people in a protest or in another demonstration, and seeking to identify those people.
Now, how would that work if I'm on the street? Obviously, there have to be public or privately owned surveillance cameras in order to track movement from point A to B to C. So if they're watching in real time, do they sit literally in front of a screen and watch me moving, or does it sort of draw a map of from camera to camera that are on this system?
The systems that we're describing are very much the cutting edge of face recognition, and we don't have too much transparency into how they work. I would imagine that different systems will actually operate a little bit differently depending on the number of cameras available, the number of personnel available to monitor the screens of possible matches. But basically what it is imagine a city with lots of surveillance cameras, like maybe New York or Chicago or the London or Moscow. And if the cameras are high enough resolution and if face recognition is connected to them, in theory, every single camera can be a point at which somebody is identified, so the camera knows exactly where they are. And if they are then caught on a different camera elsewhere, the system will know where they are then. So you could draw a comprehensive map of where somebody is at any given point in time by where their face shows up. And this is kind of a crazy concept because our face is something that we can't leave at home. We can't discard. We can't change. And in most states in the U.S. at least, we actually can't cover them up legally as well. So this raises very, very concerning privacy questions and surveillance questions. To be clear, in the U.S., we are aware of a handful of agencies that have actively looked at purchasing this technology. We are only aware of one, the Los Angeles Police Department, that has deployed in a law enforcement capacity and is actively using cameras that are performing this function.
What do you mean by in New York you can't cover up your face?
So New York and at least 20 other states have laws on the books. They're usually in the penal code, so these are very old laws that say, the New York one says two or more people walking down the street cannot walk around with their face covered, barring religious, weather, or holiday exemptions, I believe.
The mask laws, as they're called, referred to.
Yes,
yeah.
That's right. So we have a lot of states on the books have mask laws, meaning that it's not an option to cover up this particular biometric.
Claire, I'm interested in the percentage or rate of accuracy of facial recognition. We know that sometimes fingerprint matching or identification has been questioned in terms of they have experts who identify different points and you need a certain number of points to have what's deemed a fairly accurate match. How does that work with facial recognition? Are there key areas like nose, mouth, eyes that they look at, or I guess how accurate do you say it is?
The algorithms, much like fingerprint reading algorithms, do read the face based on certain nodal points that usually a company developing the algorithm has identified as being unique or relatively unique in each face. The current algorithms that are being sold and used by police today generally talk about maybe 20,000 possible nodal points on the face. So this is a lot of points. However, there are no standards stating what percentage match need to be, how many nodal points there need to be, what constitutes an actual match. So the rate of accuracy is actually very hard to measure. An important control that is in place on this is that, by and large, police departments don't view a face recognition match, so to speak, as a positive identification. Rather, these systems are designed to return a list of possible candidates from which an analyst then narrows down to possible subjects of further investigation. The problem with this, though, is what constitutes further investigation, what constitutes adequate corroboration of a face recognition possible match is far from clear, and there's no standard training or certification for the analysts conducting that final check on an identification. And the reality is, studies show us that people aren't very good at this particular task. We like to think we're good at recognizing people's faces. We recognize the faces we know. We're not very good at recognizing the faces we don't know. And so all the problems with witness identification and other human errors are also very much at play in these systems. So accuracy is hard to pin down, but generally speaking, it's less accurate than we can think of fingerprints as being. It's definitely less accurate than DNA. So the technology is new, and it definitely suffers from accuracy issues.
And I would suppose that in a courtroom scenario, one of the problems, in addition to what you mentioned as eyewitness identification being faulty at minimum, is that when jurors hear evidence is coming in that sounds scientific, for example, facial recognition software, they tend to skew toward giving it more credibility than in reality it is probably worth.
That's right. Fortunately, to date, we have not seen a prosecution introduce face recognition as evidence of an identification in court. In fact, there are two cases that have dealt with face recognition by analogy, and have generally concluded that while evidence derived from a face recognition system, such as a witness identification off of somebody being put in a lineup maybe after being possibly identified by the face recognition system, so an identification down the line, that can be admitted in court. But the consensus is that face recognition right now doesn't reach the scientific rigor required to be introduced as identification in court. That said, my big concern here is that that persuasiveness that the juries might feel, we may also see that in law enforcement as well, that if a system says, we think this is a most likely match, or this is a 90% match, that's actually very persuasive to not just to jurors who might not know about the technology, but to a law enforcement agent who then assumes that the system must be right because 90% sounds like a very close match. And so my concern is that we're seeing arrests, we're seeing people being put in lineups, we're seeing people being charged almost entirely on the basis of face recognition matches, regardless of whether they're considered an investigative lead or not.
We're speaking with Claire Garvey. Claire is a law fellow at the Georgetown Law Center on Privacy and Technology. Claire, I recently bought an iPhone 8. And they were telling me that the iPhone 10 has facial recognition capacities, which really creeped me out, and that's why I got the 8. You think that the iPhone 10 is going to normalize this technology among its users?
I very much think the integration of face recognition into the iPhone 10 will be will serve to normalize, to make people very complacent to this technology. One of the appeals of the iPhone 10 is that it's fun and convenient to open the phone with your face. We have to remember, though, that this is a convenience, and it's in some ways the stakes of a mistake on the iPhone 10 are much lower than the stakes of a mistake of a different face recognition system. If the iPhone 10 fails to recognize you, it means you have to enter your passcode to get into your phone. If the Department of Homeland Security face recognition system at an airport fails to recognize you, it may mean you can't get on the plane. If a law enforcement face recognition system fails to identify the suspect, it means that the list of possible candidates are all completely innocent individuals who may be investigated, if not arrested and charged, for a crime they don't commit. So we must be really careful, even if we choose to adopt face recognition as conveniences in various applications, such as the iPhone X, that we can't assume that all technologies are, or that all applications of the face recognition system are going to be as accurate, and that the consequences will be the same.
Claire, you may have covered some of this in what you've just told us, but I understand the Georgetown Law Center on Privacy and Technology issued a report in 2016 on this topic. What were the key findings, both cautionary, as you've just mentioned, and otherwise?
We did a survey of over 100 law enforcement agencies across the country at the state and local level, looking to see whether they use the technology and how, if they do use face recognition, how that technology is controlled. What we found is that face recognition is incredibly common, far more common than we even anticipated, and it's not under legislative or regulatory control. How common is it? As I mentioned before, over half of all American adults are in face recognition networks that are accessible to law enforcement for criminal justice searches. We estimate conservatively that more than a quarter of all law enforcement agencies in the country have access to a face recognition system. It may be less that are using it currently, but more than a quarter can actually plug into a system today if they wanted to. And paired with this, there are no laws that comprehensively address the use of face recognition, and very few policies that we have found only four public policies that control its use.
You know, Claire, the Department of Homeland Security, as I'm sure you know, created fusion centers around 2005 across the nation to better coordinate different levels of law enforcement sharing of intelligence. And they also brought in the private sector. So I am imagining that in addition to public law enforcement agencies and government intelligence firms, this information, our facial recognition patterns or imprints, are being shared with private entities.
So there are pretty strict rules on the sharing of personally identifiable information with private entities. It's possible that there are contractors who have access for the purposes of performing a government function. As far as face recognition goes, there is less sharing than I think one would imagine, both from agencies to private companies and also from private companies to agencies, because the reality is face recognition is not just a government tool. It's very, very common in the private sector as well. We're probably all the most familiar with face recognition through tag suggestions on Facebook. That is a face recognition algorithm. So face recognition happens and is used by private companies as well. My understanding is that the information sharing outside of information that's already publicly available, such as mugshot photos, is somewhat curtailed.
Well, that's a piece of good news.
Yeah. But, this is really a dystopian vision and really scary. Your report talks about the end of obscurity, and I wanted to ask you your thoughts about democracy and the right to be anonymous. If you think about it, the government shouldn't know everything about you. You should know everything about the government. It's our government. But what they've done is they've turned democracy on its head. And I think also the end of anonymity intimidates people, and it cuts against their associating with other people or speaking out about this or that, because the government knows what they're doing. It's really out of 1984, isn't it?
One of the elements of the First Amendment that the Supreme Court has recognized that an important element of our right to free speech, free association, religion, this autonomy that we are afforded, is the right to anonymity. Even though technically we present ourselves in public when we participate in a public forum or a protest, and yes, law enforcement officers are allowed to take photographs, but we would be shocked, and it would probably be seen as a violation of our rights if police officers were able to walk through a political demonstration and demand everybody show their papers, face recognition is more closely analogous to that latter situation. It's a way of identifying people. It's not just photography. So we do have to think very, very carefully about how this may begin changing public spaces, how it may chill free speech, free association, particularly on issues that are contentious, in public forums that are so vital to these conversations taking place.
Claire, tell us a bit about your work at the Georgetown Law Center on Privacy and Technology, and if you don't mind, how you became interested in this field.
I've been working with the Center on Privacy and Technology for a little over 2 years now. My focus has predominantly been on the face recognition use by law enforcement. There is a lot to explore here, and the technology is continuing to evolve and become more and more prevalent. I think an important benchmark of this is to look at how the technology is being used in Russia and China today. It's far more advanced than what we're seeing in the U.S., and yet, absent rules and regulations, we may start seeing its widespread use on demonstrations or its use to track people and identify people committing misdemeanors in the U.S., which is what's happening in Russia and China. So my focus is very much to do research and legislative advocacy around these issues. I came to the issues through a focus and education on human rights and humanitarian law, and with very much this idea that privacy, civil rights, civil liberties are human rights, and technology is what's changing that most drastically. So the controls that we need to start thinking in about today to protect our human and civil rights are the controls on new technologies.
And Claire, how can listeners either follow you on social media or learn more about, or I should say, and learn more about Georgetown Law Center on Privacy and Technology?
Sure. So we are part of Georgetown Law, and I don't know our URL offhand because it's part of the Georgetown Law website. But if you want to know more about the work we're doing, definitely look at the website for our report. It's perpetuallineup.org. Our center can be followed on Twitter at Georgetown CPT. I can be followed on Twitter at Claire Angelin, CLAREANGELYN. And I highly encourage, as people are looking at what we do, to also look at what their agencies are doing. If we have information about our report, in our report about your local agency, check it out. If we don't have information, consider sending a public records request. This information should be public. It should be accessible.
Mm, great idea, Claire. And Perpetual Lineup is a perfect title.
Yeah, perfect.
Michael and I were chuckling at that. But this has really been a pleasure, Claire, to hear your analysis, to hear some of the statistics. And we hope to stay in touch as this technology continues to enter our lives.
That would be great. There's only going to be more and more to talk about, for sure.
For sure. Okay.
Every success in exposing this, Claire.
Yes.
Thanks so much for being on Law & Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. When you're waking up, be gone. I would not beg for me, as I would not beg for you. Though I'd like to be the one to see you through. Every step you have taken disappears with the tide. You're torn up and shaken with changing your mind. You haven't got the grace to say you finally decide. And you haven't got the strength to stay to fight. Those people who surround you only want to see you weak enough to crawl. Their life you decide for you and buy up all your rights and all your wrongs. And they're trying to stop you singing in the middle of your song.
do not want you free. In the will not make you strong, but only drag you down in the hole they're coming from. They say you are foolish in wanting the sun. Say you are selfish in learning to run. Tell you that the darkness is a blessing in disguise, for you never have to notice if you're sighted or you're blind. And they'll do their best to keep you from the light. You're more than beginning, you're learning to fly. You feel like you're falling, but it passes in time. I hate to see a friend go down in flames without a song, so I'm waiting by the doorway, but I will not linger long. And I'm leaving my night, I'm leaving alone, I'm leaving a lie. When you wake and I'll be gone, I would not beg for me, as I could not beg for you.